somebody, in my opinion, back in Washington with a green eye shade is looking at just a piece about budgetary numbers.
Mayors sound off about the potential move of the F-16 squadron from Fairbanks to Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, monitoring migratory bird virus in Alaska.
One of the characteristics of avian flu viruses is that they have these 8 different genes. And if 2 viruses infect one host, one bird, then they'll swap those genes.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Air Force is holding public hearings in the Mat-Su Valley and the Fairbanks area this week on a draft environmental impact statement released last month. The EIS outlines the effects of a proposal to relocate a squadron of F-16s from Eielson Air Force Base to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Mayors from 4 communities that could be affected by the move held a press conference in Fairbanks today to reiterate their concerns with the proposal. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Even though the relocation could be economically beneficial for the Mat-Su Valley, Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan says he's still unsure about the plan. He declined to go on record in support of keeping the 18th Aggressor Squadron at Eielson Air Force Base, but he says he's concerned about the potential costs associated with relocating the aircraft to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson.
I'm concerned about the economic impact and the human impact when you've got displaced Armed Services people who are going to be forced to move. And Anchorage right now is estimated at least 150 homes short of what's required to house those folks. Where are those homes going to come from?
The draft EIS indicates a potential increase in vacancies and unemployment in and around North Pole and Fairbanks. The move could also exacerbate a housing shortage in the Mat-Su Valley. School districts in both regions could be heavily impacted, and subsequent demolition at Eielson may cost the Air Force well over $150 million. North Pole Mayor Bryce Ward says the proposal simply doesn't make sense.
Essentially, you have a short-term savings that the Air Force needs to realize right now, and that's one color of money. But the other color of money, which includes the destruction of facilities at Eielson or the moving of the aircraft, is of another color money. So in the end, you may be saving one color of money, but it might be at the cost of many others.
According to the Air Force, the move could result in a nearly $230 million savings over 5 years, but Bryce Ward says cost savings shouldn't fall entirely on the shoulders of a single Air Force base.
A little breakdown of about 10 bases that they do have in PACAP over 4 or 5 years comes down to about $5 million a base. I think that should be something that they do look at, is the impact of making all of one base take this with the uncertainty of the cost associated with that move, or asking everyone to take a shave off the top.
Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins says the draft EIS doesn't paint a complete picture.
Somebody, in my opinion, back in Washington with a green eye shade is looking at just the piece about budgetary numbers.
The Air Force is currently accepting public comments on the draft. A finalized version will be published in the Federal Register in October. A record of decision on the proposal is expected by the end of the year. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
A missile defense test conducted on July 5th failed. The Missile Defense Agency is now detailing what went wrong earlier this month with the scheduled test at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the failure could affect the expansion of the missile field at Fort Greely.
The new director of the Missile Defense Agency, Vice Admiral James Searing, says the kill vehicle failed to separate from its boosters that hurl it through the atmosphere.
The overall test was a failure because the primary objective of intercepting the target was not met.
The ground-based missile defense system has a spotty record. The program has been around for decades. Critics dubbed it the Star Wars program when it was introduced during the Reagan administration. It's been 5 years since there was a successful test. Phil Coyle used to oversee the missile defense tests at the Pentagon. He's now with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation.
That type of failure has occurred twice before in the flight intercept test.
But the Missile Defense Agency wants to move ahead with its plan to add 14 new interceptor missiles to Fort Greely by 2017. That would bring the total in Alaska to 44. Sirian vows the new missiles will be tested before they're purchased, something that hasn't always happened in the past with the ground-based system. At a hearing of the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense, Sirian told Chairman Dick Durbin the country rushed to install the missile interceptor systems because of perceived threats. Those are just one of a couple systems in the missile defense stable, including the more successful sea-based Aegis system. Durbin says the government is wasting money on the land-based system, buying missiles before they're proven to work. He dubs it flying before buying.
The deployment schedule was so demanding that there was deployment before development, deployment before proven test when it came to ground missile defense, and that was not the case when it came to Aegis.
I would agree with that, sir.
Aegis is designed to intercept shorter-range ballistic missiles. The ground-based interceptors in Alaska and California are designed to knock out long-distance missiles. Sirian says the Missile Defense Agency needs to continue testing the ground-based system.
We cannot stop testing. We must continue to test. We cannot wait another 4.5 to 5 years to test again.
Each one of those costs $214 million. The agency hopes to conduct two tests in the coming years. The next would be in March. And if that's successful, Sirian says the agency would start buying missiles for Greeley. Sirian says the Pentagon decided to expand the missile field in Alaska because of threats from North Korea. Phil Coyle says neither North Korea nor Iran has the capability of hitting the U.S. with a long-range missile yet. And he says if they had the capability, it's unlikely they'd use it.
Both Iran and North Korea have done some reckless things, but they're not suicidal. And if they were to attack the United States or Europe, or in the case of North Korea, Japan, that would be really suicidal. It would justify the most a massive retaliation that you can imagine.
While the missiles won't arrive at Fort Greely for some time, construction work refurbishing Missile Field 1 is expected to begin this summer. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The U.S. Geological Survey, with help from U.S. Fish and Wildlife and YK Delta subsistence hunters, released research this month about Western Alaska's role as an international crossroads for migratory birds and how those birds transmit avian flu viruses between each other. From Bethel, KYUK's Kyle Clayton reports.
The research began after contaminated poultry spread the H5N1 virus in China during 2005. Afterwards, multiple U.S. agencies, including Fish and Wildlife, launched nationwide research studies to find potentially infected birds across the U.S.
And one of the high-priority areas as part of that sampling was Alaska because of the known overlap of migratory pathways of birds between Asia and North America and Alaska.
That's John Pierce.
And I am the branch chief for wetlands and terrestrial ecology research here at the Alaska Science Center.
Subsistence bird hunters in the YK Delta helped provide Pierce and other researchers 24,000 samples from 82 species. They didn't find the high pathogen H5N1 in the samples, but they did find low pathogen forms.
The common cold variety.
A bird cold, that is, and not one that transfers to humans. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization, there's been no confirmed case of wild birds passing avian influenza to humans. But Pierce says it's still important to learn how birds transfer viruses between other birds as they migrate to the YK Delta from different parts of the world. It's like how a sick kid spreads a bug at school. But instead, picture a bunch of sick kids from three different schools all going on a field trip to the same museum.
Yeah, you could say that. Yep. And then, again, one of the characteristics of avian flu viruses is that they have these eight different genes. And if two viruses infect one host, one bird, then they'll swap those genes.
Pierce says viruses can quickly become pulled apart to create new bugs.
Or hybrid viruses, if you will.
These virus interactions aren't out of the ordinary, and they're relatively harmless. But sometimes along comes a perfect viral storm of genetic combinations. It happened after viruses from different animals rearranged into the H1N1 virus, better known as swine flu.
That virus was a combination of pig flu genes, avian flu genes, and human flu genes. So that virus was swapping virus gene segments among different species of animals, and it came up with a particularly, you know, bad flu strain.
Pierce says migratory birds around the world have low pathogen avian influenza, and the high pathogen viruses like H5N1 are found in poultry. Researchers are now focusing their efforts on sampling birds from the Alaskan Peninsula as they continue to track bird migrations. In Bethel, I'm Kyle Clayton.
The body of an Anchorage woman reported as missing yesterday has been found along Turnagain Arm and the Seward Highway. The Anchorage Daily News reports the remains of 58-year-old Martha Levensaler was found on the rocks along the water earlier today. Alaska State Troopers had used a helicopter to scan the Turnagain Arm shoreline between mile 105 and 108 on Tuesday, but failed to spot Levensaler at that time. Her car had been located at Beluga Point, a popular viewing spot along the highway at mile 110. A tip from the Alaska Railroad helped them find the body near mile 108 this morning. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says the case is under investigation. A state medical examiner will conduct an autopsy to determine the cause of Levensaler's death. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, working to stop the advance of invasive weeds.
These tendrils, actually, if you hold it with your finger, in time will actually start to grab you after you pick it. So they actually move slowly. It's kind of creepy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
Climbing season draws more than 1,000 adventurers to Talkeetna each summer. Most have their sights set on the summit of Denali, and this year more of them succeeded than ever before. KTNA's Philip Manning has this story as the last of the climbers prepare to return home.
Climbing season on Denali has officially ended. As of Wednesday, Park Service says there are no climbers remaining on the mountain. This year's Red Lantern climber is Dave Hahn, a guide for Rainier Mountaineering Incorporated. Hahn and his group summited on Saturday before descending and returning to Talkeetna early Wednesday morning. Hahn arrived back at base camp after even the mountaineering rangers and camp manager had returned to Talkeetna. The expedition led by Hahn made the last summit trip in what has been a record-breaking climbing season. The final summit success rate is 68%, which is the highest it has been since 1977. A total of 1,151 climbers attempted North America's tallest peak, and 787 climbers reached the top. That sets a new record for the most summits in a single year. Some of the individual expeditions were historic as well. On June 28th, a team made up of the descendants of the original summit party retraced their ancestors' steps all the way to the top. On the same day, Tom Choate of Anchorage became the oldest person to reach the summit at 78 years old. He first climbed Denali 50 years ago. According to the Park Service, there was only one fatality due to cardiac arrest, and only five climbers had to be assisted off the mountain by rangers. Of those, two were due to illness, and three were the result of what park spokesperson Maureen McLaughlin describes as minor climbing injuries. The average number of rescues in a season is closer to 15. This year's numbers are especially impressive when compared to last year, when the summit rate was 42% and six climbers perished in climbing accidents. 100 years after the first successful ascent, 2013 will also likely be remembered as a special year on Denali. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
The sockeye run to Bristol Bay is likely to be about 4 million fish short of the preseason forecast. However, commercial fishermen across Bristol Bay are celebrating a huge price increase this season. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
Over the weekend, the majority of the large processors that operate in Bristol Bay posted their base price for sockeye. Last year, Fishman left the bay with a base price of $1 a pound. This year, the base price jumped up to $1.50 a pound. There are a number of factors that likely played into the increase in the base price this year, including the emphasis on quality in recent years, which has changed the reputation of Bristol Bay sockeye. Buck Gibbons is a drifter who's still fishing down in the Ugashic District. He says the price increase is due to better quality fish and better marketing.
The fact that we've got sockeye salmon situated in practically every retail outlet across the country is starting to obviously pay some dividends, where in the situation like we were confronted with this year with a shortage of sockeye, the demand is still there, and high-quality wild salmon is here to stay, and it's a huge benefit to all of us who are in the business of harvesting it.
Gibbons has long been a proponent of chilling sockeye at the point of harvest, and last year was the first year in history that over 50% of the pack out of the bay was chilled. Getting more fish chilled at the point of harvest in the bay has also been a priority of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. CEO Norm Van Vactor has a long history in the seafood industry in Bristol Bay through his work with both Peter Pan and Leader Creek Seafoods. Van Vactor asserts that BBEDC is excited by the price increase this year.
Because this is good for our region. It speaks well to the industry. You know, in one fell swoop, there's some significant economic return to all the participants. You know, it was not a big year for most people. In fact, it's going to be a year that in all likelihood is going to come in significantly under forecast. So it's at least encouraging that in a year of a diminished return, that the ex-vessel value will hopefully come close to somewhat making up for that.
BBEDC supports the goal of increasing the quality of Bristol Bay sockeye through the two ice barges that operate in the bay that are owned by the corporation and through vessel improvement programs available to resident fishermen. Glenn Reed is the president of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association.
I think that what the world growth in farm salmon brought us was a consistent product. And while we don't have to compete with farm salmon because we have the best product in the world and it exceeds that product, we have to compete with the consistency of that product. And people want to go in the store and see that fillet that looks just like the other one, just like the other one. And I think that after the fisheries sort of bottomed out, the salmon fishery in the bay in the early 2000s, we got the benefit of the state legislature passing a tax incentive program and a tax investment credit program that allowed for the addition of a lot of quality improvements that we're now seeing and the market's seeing, and it's helping everybody. It's floating all the boats.
Last year, the preliminary ex-vessel value of the sockeye catch in Bristol Bay was just over $121 million. That was based on a base price of $1 a pound and a harvest of over 22 million sockeye. This year, the harvest will be just over 15 million fish, but the base price increased up to $1.50, not counting postseason adjustments or bonuses. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture wants to help Alaska farm producers with a program aimed at reimbursing them for at least some of the costs of transporting supplies to the state. Danny Constantine, who is the state executive director for the USDA Farm Service Agency in Alaska, says his agency administers programs that help Alaska growers and ranchers. One program that is unique to Alaska and Hawaii recognizes the fact that doing business in Alaska and exporting goods outside the state is more expensive than in other areas.
This program helps deal with some of those costs, and it provides a small reimbursement for primarily the input costs. If you're a grower and you need to buy seed or fertilizer or equipment, and that equipment is more expensive up here, this program will help you with some of those costs.
Constantine says the farm agency has just finished making payments to applicants for last year, ranging from $6,000 to $60,000.
The program is going to start again next year, and the application period is coming up. So for farmers or ranchers, you can be saving your receipts for all of those inputs and apply for the program. And next year, we'll be able to make some payments to others.
He says interested producers, and that includes oyster growers, can find information about the program on the USDA website or contact the Farm Service Agency in Palmer. The application period for next year ends in September.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Cooler, damper weather is helping firefighters working the Stewart Creek 2 wildfire outside Fairbanks. Alaska Fire Service Information Officer Bernie Panetta says the focus remains along the blaze's northeast perimeter where spot fires were corralled yesterday.
Contain and secure. These spots were 30 acres of size to 50 acres.
Overall, the fire remains at about 84,000 acres with 57% containment. Panetta says a Type 1 team that has been managing the blaze is handing over responsibility to a lower-level Type 2 organization, but the fire still poses a threat, and an evacuation advisory remains in effect for one area along Chena Hot Springs Road. Panetta says the Alaska Fire Service is tracking 80 active wildfires. Over 1 million acres have burned in Alaska so far this summer. Heavy rain is swelling streams in the Brooks Range. National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Brader says a flood warning was issued early this morning for the region where precipitation began overnight.
Some very short duration heavy rain on the north slope of the Brooks Range along the Dalton Highway from Adigan Pass up to Galbraith Lake, and several locations have had over 3/4 inch, much of that falling in just a short period of a couple hours.
The flood warning covers the crest and north slopes of the Brooks Range. Brader says there have been no reports of road or other damage so far, and adds that the region's larger rivers are not forecast to flood. He says rain is predicted to move across the interior, including the Alaska Range, a significant event given what's been a very dry summer.
We are expecting heavy rain to move into southwest Alaska tomorrow and move over the Alaska Range tomorrow night and Friday. That's going to be more rain than we've had all the rest of the summer, it looks like.
Brader says up to a half inch of rain is expected in the Fairbanks area Thursday through Friday night. Weed-whacking warriors tackled invasive plants last weekend during an annual event sponsored by the Palmer Soil and Water Conservation District. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer went along with them on a search and destroy mission to eradicate non-native plants.
That's the sound of a weed-pulling team hard at it on a beautiful Saturday in Palmer.
This stuff does work. Out, does it?
With our matching red t-shirts and white cotton gardener's gloves, we could be mistaken for cartoon characters, but we are on a serious mission to eradicate a botanical pest. It's called bird vetch. Mark Muck is with the State Division of Forestry, and today he's leading a group of volunteer weed pullers at a local park. He says a good many invasive plants were brought to Alaska by chance.
They can come across by shipping. People can drive up here, actually, and it can be via vehicle. Even naturally, birds and everything else can actually bring invasives into different areas, too.
Others got here when they were actually imported for a reason. Bird vetch, our target pest, was spread along new roadways to stabilize soil. That was a mistake. The plant looks absolutely non-threatening at first. It's got pretty bluish-purple flowers and fringed leaves growing off a tiny stem, thin as microfilament. But allow it to grow a year or two, and it will create a living tsunami covering every other plant in its path. Muck says it creates a monoculture. It can take over so completely that it allows nothing else to live.
It has this purple flower, and the flower is all on one side of the stem. You can kind of look at it. It has these little tendrils that actually bind to all the other vegetation. But these tendrils, actually, if you hold it with your finger, in time will actually start to grab you after you pick it. So they actually move slowly. It's kind of creepy.
Our group of 10 adults and kids is working at Lucas Kiwanis Park, and there is plenty of bird vetch to be pulled here, especially near the kids' play area. We each get a plastic bag and start pulling the weeds away from the soil. It's not hard work, but it does reveal the depths of the problem. I uncover a struggling wild currant and a shrub with pretty yellow berries that I couldn't even see before the invasive vetch was pulled away. The bird vetch is so thick that it is climbing a baby cottonwood and strangling fireweed in its march up the hill.
And you see where it goes in the ground?
Mm-hmm.
And then, rather than just pulling up here, what this will do is it'll just rip it right off at the seams. But if you get down and you get in and you get some of this root system in here, you can actually, it may not come back. It's more likely to come back if we leave a root system in the ground. So, yeah.
This year, about 70 people showed up in support, like weed warrior Mary Donlin.
So I started applying myself pretty seriously to studying plants. And once you do that, the invasives get a hold of you, because they're everywhere. And you go, what is this plant that is choking everything out? And in this case, of course, we have the bird vetch. And it doesn't look natural, and it's taking away the space and energy and everything for other plants. So you go, okay, that's an imbalance. What else is going on?
We pull up the vetch and some pesky toad flax, too, until early afternoon. After our work, the little hillside next to the playground looks completely different. Now it's an open, grassy spot with bright fireweed and inviting green grass, where before it looked like a tropical jungle. Louisa Branch Flower, a natural resources manager with the Palmer Soil and Water Conservation District, says there's many varieties of invasive plant species. White sweet clover and reed canary grass are two on the hit list.
Well, it can cause a lot of problems economically. It's a nuisance. It gets into people's gardens, it gets into people's farms, and can cause crop damage. It can be a problem for wildlife, for fish. You know, some of the like reed canary grass and some other plants can get into the salmon streams and change the geomorphology of the stream, and that can be bad for salmon rearing habitat.
As a souvenir of our day battling weeds, we each receive a small booklet detailing the various invasives cropping up in Alaska. Then it's back to downtown for some music and a barbecue. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Kyle Clayton in Bethel, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Ellen Lockyer in Palmer. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskananookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.